All right, so how many people printed out the laboratory activity guide from the website? Did you bring it with you? Well, I didn't notice until today that it wasn't up there, but you did. That's nice. Therefore, I have one copy per group that you can use while you're here, but you still need to print your own one, your own out from now on. I mean, to use from now on. That thing's useful, though, because the syllabus tells you what chapters we're doing. The activity guide tells you what parts of the chapter you can skip. So that's useful information. It'll allow you to be here a shorter amount of time than if you just try to do the complete chapters based on the syllabus. Another thing I didn't realize, and that this is because this wasn't on Ken's syllabus, so I didn't realize this until just today, is that we're not doing just 25 and 26 today. We're also doing 24, which is prokaryotes. All right, so there will be some things in 24, which is not even addressed on the activity guide, because I think this was just been added recently, the last time they taught it, which didn't include me. Anyway, you're not doing 24 is easier anyway. It's basically just looking at stuff. Really, all of tonight is mostly just looking at stuff, but you have to make some slides. Just if there's something that you can't find the materials for in 24, that probably means we're not doing it. 25 and 26, though, the activity guide tells you what we're not doing. So remind me to give those to the groups after I talk just a little bit. I don't want to talk too long because there's a lot of stuff to look at, mostly looking through scopes. And by the way, looking through a scope is not as easy as it sounds. Properly using a microscope is actually difficult. And almost certainly none of you is good at it yet. We're using light microscopes. More specifically, we're using slide microscopes as opposed to dissection microscopes. But these slide microscopes are also examples of compound microscopes. What is it that makes them compound? No one has a clue? So if I asked you that on a quiz, you would just leave it blank, everyone? You have no idea. See, I don't believe that. I think you're just not telling me. Have you heard of a compound microscope? But you never learned what that was? Or you just never cared to learn? Someone's got a guess. Well, what makes a microscope a simple microscope, the other kind of microscope? A simple scope is one in which light goes through only one lens before it hits your eye. A compound scope has two different types of lenses, and light goes through one lens first, gets magnified a certain amount, or the image does, and then the image gets magnified again because the light goes through a second type of lens before it hits your eyes. What are the two types of lenses? Two categories. Anyone know? The ones that... go ahead and open up your scopes. The ones that you can choose from among by twisting this piece right here are called objective lenses. And they're called that because they are close to the object that you're magnifying. What are the ones that you actually look through called? The other type. Those are called ocular lenses. Yeah, ocular simply means of the eye. So objective lens, light goes through first, then it goes through an ocular lens, and that's what makes it compound. It's not the fact that it has two oculars. That makes it binocular. And that not all compound scopes have two oculars. But this is also, this is not only a compound scope, it's one that allows you to choose from different objectives, which are mounted on this swivel. That swivel is called the nose piece. And so that's how you adjust magnification, by choosing from among different objective lenses. This scope is also an example of one that's called parfocal. Parfocal means staying at least roughly in focus when you change objectives. So you always focus first with the lowest power objective, which is called the scanning lens. Get that as perfect as you can for your eyes. And then when you go up in magnification by going to the next higher power by swiveling the nose piece, since it's a parfocal scope, it should be still roughly in focus, and all you should ever have to touch is the fine focus knob. The coarse focus should only be used for the scanning lens. All right, and also keep in mind that the ocular lenses can be adjusted by moving them farther apart and closer together to adjust for your interpupillary distance. So if you tell me this scope doesn't work with my eyes, I have to close one eye, that just means you're not adjusting the interpupillary distance properly. You have to customize these things to your eyes. And also, one of the oculars focuses on its own so that you can make up any difference between your focusing ability between your two eyes. That's how you get good images. But also, part of getting good images is preparing the slides well to begin with. And so when you look at prepared slides that are purchased, those are the ones that are nice and beautiful, like in textbook pictures. Things don't just look like that. Most cells are not colored. You know, plant cells are. Other photosynthetic cells have some color in them naturally. But the colors you see, the different colors within a cell, are because of different staining techniques. And notice that in 24, the one you didn't realize you had to do before coming in tonight, it describes Gram staining. It actually suggests that you're doing the Gram staining, you're not. Gram staining has just been put out as a demo. But read about Gram staining and know the difference in how they look and why they look different based on what the difference in the cell types are that make them stain differently with the Gram staining technique. Okay? This scope, we didn't find a good example of, so just ignore it. But the rest of the stuff is sitting out for you to look at. Quickly, though, let's go over some basics about classification, because this is the first of several meetings in which we're going to be working from the manual and surveying different groups of organisms. It's the first taxonomic meeting, basically. Taxonomic means having to do with classification, right? And in the modern classification of organisms, it's changed since I was a kid, and it continues to change. But when I was first taught about classification, probably fifth grade or so, 40 years ago, kingdoms were the biggest groups, and there were only three kingdoms at the time. Well, no, there were five by then, but that's now totally different. We realized along the way that kingdoms aren't what we should have as the biggest groups, and therefore an even larger or more inclusive taxon, which is just a name for any of these groups at any of the levels, was added. And what is that? What's the most inclusive taxon? Domain, exactly. And there are how many domains in life? Three domains, yeah. Now, this is separate from the dichotomy, or the two-part separation of cells into two types. There are two types of cells, right? Fundamentally speaking. And what are those two types? When you consider any cell, you can lump it into one of two groups unambiguously. Prokaryotic cells and eukaryotic cells. That karyo part of the word that both words share comes from a root carion, which means kernel or core. And so karyo, when it's applied to cells, refers to the core of the cell or the kernel of the cell, which is the nucleus, right? Prokaryotes are organisms that have a prokaryotic cell. That means literally before the nucleus. Pro means before. So it just means these cells came about, evolved before the nucleus evolved. And they still don't have a nucleus. A true nucleus is a membrane-bounded organelle. Membrane-bounded means enclosed by a membrane. So something that's a true nucleus is enclosed by its own membrane within the cell. You don't find that in any prokaryotic cell, and that's the essence of the name. But in addition to not having membrane-bounded nucleus, a prokaryotic cell also doesn't have any other membrane-bounded organelles, like mitochondria or endoplasmic reticulum or chloroplasts. They do have ribosomes, which are organelles, but organelles are not membrane-bounded, right? They are just molecular structures. They're not enclosed by their own membrane. So that's the dichotomy of cell types. You have prokaryotic cells and eukaryotic cells. But we have three domains. One of those domains includes every organism made up of eukaryotic cells, and that's why it's called eukarya. That's the one we belong to, right? We're animals. All animals are eukaryotic organisms. And so that's our domain. But there is no prokarya domain. Eukarya is a proper domain, includes all eukaryotic organisms that have ever existed. Prokaryotes, though, are put into one or another of the other two domains. What are those other two domains? Right, archaea and bacteria. Domain names are capitalized. So when you write archaea, bacteria, or eukarya, and you're talking about the domains, it should be a capitalized word. Now, you can probably guess, if you don't already know, what type of organisms are in the domain called bacteria. It includes all the bacteria since the beginning of life, which includes by far most of the organisms that have ever lived. Bacteria are now by far the most numerous organisms, and they always have been. It's never come close to a time in which things have outnumbered bacteria. So you could also say they're, as a group, they're the most successful organisms ever. Archaea, to look at them without being an expert, seem very much like bacteria. And there's good reason for that. They're both prokaryotes, right? But what distinguishes archaea from prokaryotes is important differences molecularly in how the cells are built. They have different kinds of cell walls compared to bacteria. Other molecular differences that are important, but they look pretty much like bacteria. Same size, about. They're all. Another important point is that all prokaryotes are unicellular. Now, it's not true that all eukaryotes are unicellular. It is true that all true multicellular organisms are eukaryotic. But eukarya also includes some unicellular organisms. Okay? But another difference between archaea and bacteria is really their lifestyle. Archaea are extremophiles, meaning that they thrive in environments that would kill other kinds of cells. And this might explain the phylogenetic data that point to the probability that archaea are the closest everything we have still existing to that original cell that we all come from. Because when the first cell was here, when the first cells were created on Earth, Earth was a hell of a lot different from what it is now. It was really an extreme environment. Very hot. Chemistry was totally different. No oxygen. Much different from how it is now. Well, archaea still thrive in those kinds of situations. So they can live at temperatures above boiling water, which would kill just about everything else. Bacteria, on the other hand, you'll find anywhere there's life, you'll find bacteria. They are ubiquitous, meaning found everywhere. So that's a big difference between the two types of prokaryotes, which are in their own domain. Another interesting thing about it is that we're always changing classification, by the way. When we draw phylogenetic trees, which are these family trees that show the relationships between groups of organisms, those are always being rearranged as we accumulate more and more data. Nowadays, a lot of that data has to do with DNA, which is a reliable way to tell the relatedness of organisms, because a lot of shared DNA means that there hasn't been much times for mutation to make these two lineages different from each other. Anyway, when you go to the overall tree of life, usually when you look at a cladogram, which is the name for one of these trees, it will only be a little subset of everything. You're concentrating on animals, for instance. It'll just show only the animal lineage. But there's one grand tree, if you were to draw it all, that would have a bunch of lines in it. It goes back to that original cell that we all sprang from. When you draw it that way, what we see is the division that led to the three domains that we recognize today. And even though archaea seem very much, when you look at them, like bacteria, the evidence suggests pretty strongly that archaea are actually more related to eukarya, us, than either eukarya or archaea is related to bacteria. So there are really big, important differences between bacteria and archaea, even though they are both prokaryotes. Well, 25 and 26 are both about eukaryotes, right? But specifically, not about the eukaryotes that most people think about day to day. Eukaryotes include, or eukarya, the domain, includes all plants, all animals, all fungi. And what those three have in common is that they include a lot of multicellular organisms, right? Truly multicellular, meaning not just a group of cells that can live independently but just happen to be clumped together. A multicellular organism has cells of different types doing different things for the whole group of cells. Anyway, all truly multicellular organisms are in eukarya, but like I said earlier, not all eukaryotes are multicellular. There are a bunch of unicellular ones, and most of those unicellular ones are lumped together in a group that isn't really an official taxon within phylogeny, but that is called protists. Protists used to be an official taxon in the old scheme. That's been scrapped, but we still use the word protist as a kind of a rough catch-all. Protist means any eukaryote other than an animal, a plant, or a fungus. Most of those, though, are unicellular. So protist roughly, although not exactly, means unicellular eukaryote. And that's what you're studying in these two chapters. Notice that they're not all unicellular, though, like kelp or brown algae are not unicellular. So 25 is about algae, and they're lumped together because they have in common with each other the fact that they're photosynthetic. They're not plants. They have some things in common with plants, but they're not plants. Algae are their own group of eukaryotes. And there's, I think you're covering six major groups of algae. Three of which are called algae based on their color, right? Brown algae, green algae, and red algae. Color differences are due to different photosynthetic pigments that are in the cells that absorb the light. But then you also have dinoflagellates, euglenoids, and diatoms. Diatoms are interesting things because they are single cells that make a cell wall out of glass. So they're like a little jewelry case. There's a bottom and a top, and the top slides right over the bottom. It's made out of glass, but it has little holes in it so the cell can live. Obviously, that's a very protective device. So they're not only cool for that reason, but they have very nice geometric shapes to them, and there's all kinds of different shapes. So make sure you get a good look at those. That's 25, and then 26 is about protozoans and slime molds. Although I think we're skipping the slime mold, part of the slime molds thing, because we're going to lump that together with fungi. Anyway, the protozoans, though, why are they called protozoans? Which was one of the quiz questions tonight, right? What does zo mean? What is zoology? What kind of organisms are housed in a zoo? Animal. Zo means animal. So protozoan literally means very early animal. They're not technically animals, officially, so the name is really a misnomer. But they're called that because their lifestyle is very much like animals. Whereas algae have a lifestyle more similar to plants. Okay? So keep all that in mind when you look at the major groups. Get a good look at all the examples. And you should be taking notes, because you'll have to identify stuff come practicum time. And the nice thing about modernity and the ubiquity of smartphones is that it's really easy and inexcusable not to, therefore, take a picture of what you see on the slide. Because you can get really good shots through the ocular if you have the right kind of phone. All right, so do that.